Il-program li ser tisimaw huwa miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.
This is Patricia Camilleri, welcoming you to University Matters on Campus FM. In this series, together, we shall continue to discover more about the work of the university's academics and about the many activities that will be taking place on campus over the next year. This is one of the mini series of programs that University Matters is organizing on Campus FM as part of the celebration of the Faculty for the Built Environment's centenary, 1915 to 2015. And I'm very pleased to have with me two members of the faculty today. One is Perit Dr. Mark Bonello, and the other is Perit Adrian Mifsud. Welcome to you both. Since our time is rather short, I should start off with Dr. Bonello, and then we'll pass on to Perit Mifsud. A short word about our guest. Dr. Bonello is a senior lecturer in the Department of Civil and Structural Engineering in the Faculty Office of the Built Environment. He received his tertiary education here at the university and later as a Commonwealth Scholar and an Overseas Research Scholar. He followed a master's degree and doctoral studies in structural reliability theory at the Imperial College of Science, Technology and Medicine at the University of London. An architect and a structural engineer by profession, Dr. Bonello lectures at the University of Malta. Research interests include seismic vulnerability of masonry, steel and reinforced concrete buildings and structural restoration of historic and prehistoric monuments. What we shall be mentioning today is seismic vulnerability of masonry buildings in the Maltese Islands. Perhaps you could highlight the main research activities and also talk about the possibility of seismic activity in Malta, which is perhaps is underrated.
In fact, quite correct, actually. We actually don't have a culture for seismic design in Malta, and probably that stems from the fact that we have a false sense of security, that earthquakes aren't something that occur at all in Malta. However, if one had to look closely at data that is being gathered on a daily basis by the seismological stations that are actually operated by the University of Malta, the physics department, there is a certain amount of activity going on even as we speak, even though the seismic activity is too weak to be noticed by human beings. In fact, they can only be measured by sensitive instruments. However, it actually should be noted that in the last sort of 250 odd years, Malta has actually experienced around six strong earthquakes, whose epicenter, of course, was quite far away. I mean, some of them, for example, were in Greece or North Africa. And yet, these earthquakes had quite significant impacts on the Maltese buildings. Of course, we know this through historical records that have recorded, for example, damages to churches and cathedrals, palaces and buildings owned by government. Not much, of course, is written about what happened to private buildings, because, of course, that probably wouldn't have been of much interest to the historians at that point. And therefore, seeing that there's this sort of periodic occurrence, even though it stretches over decades and perhaps even centuries, there's nothing to stop another strong earthquake from hitting Malta soon. I augur that this would not be the case, but let me also be realistic that statistically it will happen. There's no doubt about it. I mean, whether it will be in our lifetime or not, but it will happen. And what is therefore important is for us to be well-equipped and prepared for such an event. Now, traditionally in Malta, architects have designed their buildings to withstand vertical loading, consisting of the self-weight of the building, and also the imposed loads on the building emanating from the use of the building, whether it's a factory or a hospital or an office or a block of apartments, as well as also horizontal loading, which emanates from primarily wind loading. We know, of course, that the effect of earthquakes is to induce strong horizontal loading on buildings. And thus far, it has not been very common for Maltese architects and, of course, periti, because the word perit in Malta means the architect and the civil structure engineer. So our local periti are not well versed to deal with horizontal loading due to seismic activity. Of course, in recent years, at least for about 10 years now, we've been lecturing at university the newer crop of students on this subject, because it's important that they have an awareness. But certainly, let's say the older generation of architects, unless they've carried out any courses on their own initiative or perhaps CPD courses, they would probably not have an exposure to this kind of of subject. And therefore, it is important that within our design, we also must take account of seismic effects. Traditionally, we've actually been a country, certainly before Malta joined the EU, where architects have depended primarily upon design codes and codes of practice, which were issued by the British Standards Institution. For obvious historical reasons, Malta having been a colony for Britain for almost 150 years. Our misfortune is, however, that since Britain is not really afflicted by earthquakes, even in Britain itself there isn't a strong culture on earthquakes, and this, of course, has also permeated to Malta and its former British colonies. However, one has to say that in Malta our seismic exposure is much higher than in Britain. Therefore, our awareness to the effects of earthquakes on local buildings is really a consequence of us joining the European Union. Ever since we've joined the European Union, we've actually now shifted from using British standards, which in any case have been phased out, to European codes. They're actually called Eurocodes.
But these are codes or legal directives? How much legal standing do they have?
Well, actually, these are best codes of practice. However, since April 2010, they are the only ones around because member states have agreed to phase out their own national codes in favor of the Eurocodes. For example, this means, therefore, that any further development of British standards codes is not possible. So, as of April 2010, the development of those codes has stopped. So clearly, if you want to be abreast with the latest design information, you have to use the Eurocodes. Of course, from a legal point of view, if you can prove that you have applied the Eurocodes in the correct manner, and that means it's a state of the art, then if anything happens to your building, you are covered professionally, in other words, the architect, the perit, is covered professionally, as in having used state of the art, and therefore, any consequence of failure would have been, for example, the effect of a lack of knowledge in the industry rather than in that particular architect. So it pays us to use these Eurocodes. And there's a particular Eurocode, which is called Eurocode 8, which refers to seismic design. And this has now become standard, a part of our curriculum in the course at university for students, and therefore, obviously, it is a very important aspect in design, one which I hope will also lead to an assessment of buildings which were constructed in the past and which obviously didn't have perhaps seismic design as a component in that design process. Having said this, however, this does not mean that buildings that were constructed in the past, that were not therefore assessed from a seismic point of view, would necessarily fail if an earthquake had to occur. Whether or not a building will fail during an earthquake is a matter for assessment. And obviously, nowadays, with building owners wanting to insure their properties and so on, and with insurance companies requiring an assessment from a seismic point of view, because as you know, there is also cover for earthquakes, this now makes it even more demanding on building owners to try and obtain some kind of an assessment for buildings which they knew or they know were not designed seismically. Of course, what is the prospect for a building owner if he carries out an assessment with an architect and finds out that his building would not withstand the earthquake, which is typical for the Maltese Islands? Really, he has two options. He can either demolish his building and rebuild it, but that, of course, is extremely expensive.
Wouldn't be very pleased.
Especially if he's renting out or if parts of the building have been already sold out. The other possibility is to retrofit the building and to strengthen it. And even there could be problems, because maybe if you want to pass a column through all the apartments of an apartment block, this means that all the apartment owners have to agree. So, there are also these practical aspects which come into play. From a seismic point of view, the whole picture actually can be represented in this triangular relationship between what is known as seismic hazard, which is essentially the exposure of a site, the probability that an earthquake will hit a location within a specified period of time, seismic risk, which has to do with the type of construction that is used for a building. So a building with good construction, anti-seismic construction, in a zone with a high seismic hazard would probably fare better than a building with poor construction in a zone of low seismic hazard. So seismic hazard on its own is not enough to assess whether a building will sustain the earthquake or not. And finally, the third component of this triangle relationship is seismic vulnerability, and this is the susceptibility of a building to damage during an earthquake with respect to a reference period. Typically, in the case of normal buildings, the reference period, which is the design life of structures, is around 50 years. But for major infrastructural projects like, I don't know, like hospitals, for example, or airports, seaports, breakwaters, bridges, and so on, that reference period can go up to around 100 years. So it's quite a long time when you think about it.
Can I ask a question about the difference in the type of buildings that are being built in Malta now?
Okay.
I mean, you're talking about masonry buildings, houses, which until a few years ago might have been 2, 3, 4.
In fact,
and then, I don't know, then the Preluna came up in the 70s, 13 absolutely. Floors. And now we're really going up. What are the differences, really, between
you're quite correct.
The types of building?
Actually, if you look at historic buildings, you will find that they have fared pretty well in the course of time. Remember, most of these historic buildings, they date back before these 250 years that I've mentioned. But the main reason for that is that, first of all, these buildings are rarely higher than 3, 4 floors. And secondly, they employ massive construction. The walls are thick, the rooms are small, the roofs are robust, and therefore it's quite a robust configuration. What's happened is over the years, modern construction in Malta has taken a different route, in the sense that obviously with technological advances in reinforced concrete and structural steel, and even in the use of masonry and reinforced masonry, our buildings have tended to become more slender. We use thinner walls, higher floors, more open plan sort of rooms and areas, especially if the building has to be used for purposes which require these open plans, like offices, for example, or perhaps libraries or whatever. And therefore, our buildings have become more susceptible to earthquake effects. I should also add that with recent planning laws requiring building owners to provide parking underground underneath the building to relieve the streets from street parking requirement, this has meant that the basement level is usually devoid of any walls, which means that you have a situation where you have a building on stilts, those stilts being the party walls separating different buildings from each other, spanned over, the basement is spanned over by strong pre-stressed concrete panels. And then you have the normal building above those panels with smaller rooms and so on. So effectively, when an earthquake hits a building, especially if the building is on its own, and, you know, it's not uncommon for, especially new sites, for a building temporarily to be on its own before the next door neighbor decides to build. That is probably the worst time when these buildings are exposed to earthquakes, because their resistance to earthquakes is, well, somewhat of concern, I should say. Of course, this is a type of building, let's say, methodology that has been used because it is the cheapest type of construction. It's load-bearing. Typically, this kind of construction is used to up to around 8 or 9 floors, but not more than that, because then we start getting problems with crushing of stone because of the weight, the vertical weight at the very bottom of the building. And these buildings usually do not have what are known as framed structures within them. Now, framed structures, which can be made out of steel or concrete, allow the building owner flexibility in the sense that if you have a frame structure, every floor can have partitions of its own. The partitions, which are made of stone usually, but they can be made of light materials, but if they're made of stone, they don't have to be on top of each other. In other words, they're not load-bearing. This also means that the building owner can change the position of these partitions from time to time, depending on the use of the building, depending on the requirements of tenants, for example, for smaller or larger spaces, etc. With load-bearing structures without frames, of course, this means that gravity loads become even more important, and the effects of horizontal loads are even more significant. So this is, in fact, the reason why the faculty have now entered into for the past two years, we have been working together with our Italian partners from Sicily, so the University of Malta, the University of Catania, the University of Palermo, the Civil Protection Department of Malta, and also the one from Sicily, together have sort of pooled together the resources. We have also obtained EU funding through the Italia-Malta 2007 and 2013 EU funding instrument. And the purpose of this study is to precisely determine the seismic vulnerability of load-bearing masonry buildings, and therefore I emphasize buildings which do not have frame structures within them, in Malta, in Catania, and also in Lampedusa. Obviously, there have to be an Italian component. Of course, what interests us particularly is our own buildings, You know, to summarize our work, what we're actually doing is we are surveying or actually obtaining NEPA permits for typical buildings that exist. We've taken two test sites, one at Shemshiya and the other at Nadur in Gozo, both of which have similar geological formations. So we have a thin layer of rock underlaid by means of a deep layer of clay. And so when an earthquake hits that area, not only do we have the normal earthquake effects that one would experience on a rock formation, but there's also the amplification of displacements due to the presence of clay, and that makes the response of the building even higher. And so we need to understand what are the typical configurations and the number of parameters that can affect seismic vulnerability of our buildings. There are many parameters, perhaps too many, I would say, because when one looks at the permutations and combinations of these parameters, it's mind-boggling as to how much work needs to be carried out in order to understand how strong or how weak our structures are. Certainly, our task, or at least our objective, is twofold. First of all, to provide the local civil protection department with a form which, I mean, whilst we're carrying out our analysis using sophisticated computer numerical modeling techniques and so on, we do not expect the civil protection department personnel to carry out those analyses on their own. So obviously what we are doing is we're developing a form which can be filled in by even a semi-technical person from the civil protection department that will provide a rapid means of assessment of the vulnerability of a building. At the same time, of course, that form is being calibrated by means of our computer models. Of course, we're looking at, first of all, we started out by looking at the behavior of one building on its own, as if it were totally independent. And then the next thing is to look at what happens when the building forms part of an aggregate, a block of buildings.
Perhaps I can just turn to Peet Vassoud and mention very briefly that he's a geotechnical engineer and member of the Department of Civil and Structural Engineering, as well as working in private practice. Originally an architect and structural engineer, he's specialised in engineering problems related to the ground that we build upon. This is studied through the two disciplines of soil mechanics and rock mechanics. His area of research deals with trying to understand the behavior of the local weak rocks and clays when these are loaded and unloaded, and this has practical implications, limiting damage to neighboring properties, etc. I suppose we better go straight into the main area that you'll be discussing today, and that's, as I suggested before in the bio, is weak rocks. And perhaps you could define weak rocks for us.
Yes, the problem here, Malta, is that we tend to think of, you know, that all our buildings are founded on a very strong material. Now, as we go higher and we excavate deeper, obviously, strength is relative. So we've got materials which maybe are not as strong as we would like them to be. They might be fractured, they might not be well cemented together from their natural state. And so there are many different situations which we have to deal with. To the layman, these things are experienced in the form of movement in buildings. Now, for example, the buildings which are founded on relatively weak materials tend to settle with time, and we experience this settlement in the form of cracks around our buildings or in our bathroom tiles. We experience this effect when, for example, the neighboring properties are excavated, and although the building does not fall down, it tends to move slightly, and again it's damaged in the process, the neighboring properties. So my area of research is trying to understand how these materials behave. And we might want to define, first of all, the difference between the clays, which everyone knows are relatively malleable and relatively soft, you can easily mold them with your hands, and the harder rocks, the material, for example, we build with, we use for our masonry structures. In between those two, there is a whole spectrum of other materials, which tend to be slightly stiffer than the clays, but perhaps not as strong as the rock we build with. It's useful to consider also the mechanical properties of these materials. And they tend to be challenging because they fall within a middle ground that is between the science of soil mechanics, which deals with the weaker materials, and the discipline of rock mechanics, which deals with the harder materials. These tend to fall somewhere in between. And so even on the international scene, they're a bit of a challenge because everyone is trying to understand how these materials behave. And given that we have plenty of these, our research is being focused on understanding the weaker ones that we have here. And as an example, we've taken, as you said, the church at Birkirkara, which is built on a very weak rock material and which has experienced a lot of settlement during its lifetime. So much that almost 100 years after it was built, its roof collapsed. We have studied this church extensively, myself and also some undergraduate students, and we have found out that its walls have actually moved sideways and they have sunk into the ground. And as a result, the masonry vaults and the dome actually lost their lateral support and came falling down. The church was abandoned for quite some time, hundreds of years in fact, and only very recently, in the last 40 years, it has been rebuilt, restored, and it is now being used again. However, unfortunately, there are signs that it is again on the move. So we've seen cracks, we've seen movement, we have experienced mortar which is falling from the roof.
So when it was restored, it was shored up in some
way. Yes, it was shored up.
But not enough.
Well, I wouldn't say it
was last.
Yeah, I mean, the movement was not perhaps anticipated. And we are seeing that there is some movement, albeit very small. And so we're trying to understand what's happening below the ground. And in fact, we've taken specimens of the rock, which tends to be very hard at the top. But it was probably very misleading to the builders at the time, because they found a hard layer and they thought they had found the stronger material. However, about 50 centimeters down below that layer, there's this weak material, which I am currently studying. And we're subjecting this material to all kinds of tests to try to understand its mechanical properties, the effect that water within its pores has, its deformational properties, and so on. And we've got some quite interesting results because we've managed to identify modes of behavior that we weren't expecting, you know, long-term deformation under the same load and things like that, which are obviously quite important if then we come to predict what's going to happen with new constructions. Luckily, we have all the tools nowadays available which we can use to model such, for example, such excavations. And so having the appropriate mathematical models which we can use in these type of calculations is obviously very useful, because we can predict through these models how much the neighboring property, for example, could move with a particular type of excavation or with a particular type of intervention. The problem is getting these mathematical models in place in the first place. So this research is being focused towards understanding the behavior and providing a mathematical description of this behavior, which hopefully one day can be used in the modeling process. Again, it's being done in terms of the effect of water, the effect of cracks that exist within the rock, and so on. You know, there are the parameters are endless.
It becomes
quite a complex mathematical problem, in fact. One other area of research which is complementary to the study is a study which I'm doing with a number of other members in the industry, which has to do with channeling rainwater into the local rocks. We've been pumping the aquifer for quite some time now, and we managed to lower its level by substantial amount. And so there was this idea, which was the brainchild of Marco Cremona, to channel the water from the roofs into the rocks.
To refill in the basic
terms.
Yes,
in some way
to replenish
and recharge the water table. Now, obviously, this all depends on how the water travels through the rock, through the pores of the rock, and through all the cracks that exist down there, which is obviously very complementary to what I'm trying to do from the mechanical point of view. So the two things tend to be helping each other. We also have a team where these rocks, again, are being studied in terms of the water flow within, in terms of the effect of negative suction within, and in terms of the flow through the discontinuities, through the cracks. Hopefully this project will one day end up in providing some kind of guidance to all those who would like to retrofit their buildings in terms of, for example, for those people who do not have a well or a reservoir, they can possibly carry out such an installation in the form of drilling a borehole and then channeling the water from the roof into the ground. One challenge with this idea is to make sure that the water is not contaminated. And obviously how much the ground can actually filter out the contaminants. So this is again another aspect of this research.
What would have happened in the natural state when there weren't any buildings?
Yes.
The rain would have fallen, and it would have sort of filtered down, gone through clay, gone through different various layers, and then be nice and pure when it got to the water table.
Yes, exactly.
But now we have to learn how to do it.
Yeah, from scratch.
From scratch. Or artificially, in a way, I suppose.
Yes.
And that obviously must ring very much a bell with our listeners, because, of course, what is happening at the moment is that the rainwater does overflow into the sewers, unfortunately,
into the sewers,
for one reason or another, which you might or might not want to go into, and to create the situation as, I mean, I don't think I'm uncovering any secrets if I say the Barsan Valley Road really smells badly when we have flooding.
The sewerage system then doesn't cope with So this will have, if it is successful, it will have many beneficial effects in terms of you know, replenishing the aquifer, easing the load on the current infrastructure, and hopefully, you know, resulting in a more sustainable way of doing things, you know.
And could also the way in which we build our residences now, which are, we have to build them, I suppose, people need buildings, but perhaps they can be built in such a way that these systems can be built into the plan, rather than, I mean, obviously you have to refit an older building, but thinking to the future, you should be able to do it beforehand and not have to...
That's the idea. And in fact, it's not only that, but also the possibility of actually doing it where it was overlooked. Because that's the main challenge. You know, most of our islands are already built up, or we have a very large built-up area, which you cannot really simply demolish to retrofit in this sense. So having a borehole which can be drilled relatively easily through a basement or perhaps through an open area, and possibly channeling the rainwater, I think is a brilliant idea which should be investigated.
Mm-hmm. And this is something that needs the academic input of the university, of the faculty in this case, coupled with the real world. I mean, that's not a very good way of putting it, but the engineers that are actually working out there and the collaboration between the two, which is, I think, this is the way the faculty is looking now, looking outwards, no longer sort of simply bricks and mortar, but certainly to be of use to society. I'd like to thank Dr. Mark Bonello and Perit Idrimifsud for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to University Matters on Campus FM. Do join me again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.
Il-programm li għadkom kem smajtu kien miġjub lilkom bix-xewqa tajba ta' Farsons Foundation.